guys, welcome to another episode of Work in Progress. This is Sim.
This is Ko.
And welcome to our all new episode. We have a really exciting guest with us today. Ko will go through who he is and what he's done.
So today we're very excited to have Mikhil Inani with us, who's very graciously agreed to come. We've had to, for the first time, print out his bio because it is so long and impressive. So I shall just introduce him. He is the CEO and MD of Apollo Finvest. Prior to that, he was the consumer product head at Hotstar. Prior to that, he also co-founded Farm Easy. And he also was a product manager at Coupon Dunya. And he also has a master's degree in information systems from Carnegie Mellon. And I think he's been in the industry for over 8 years now and has diverse roles. And we're very, very excited for him to join us today. So, hello.
Thank you so much for having me.
And sorry if I faltered at all in the introduction.
I mean, a couple of points. One is, I was actually head of product at Coupon Dunya.
Okay.
So that's the only thing. And unfortunately, I'm a little bit older. I have like now almost 11 plus years of experience.
Wow. So yeah. It makes it more impressive. So.
Yeah, no, it's just, you know, making me older, but maybe you stick with yours.
And so like we mentioned earlier, we've obviously gone through the literature of things that are out there in the universe about you. But we want to mix it up a bit and, you know, simplify everything that you do, the ambitions that your company has and that you have. And so before we get into your personal journey, we're going to straight get into, you know, what you're doing with Apollo Finvest and this idea that it is the AWS of lending. We want you to sort of elaborate on that and, you know, explain it like you were explaining it to a 10-year-old.
Yeah, awesome. I mean, so, you know, I'll tell you, when you think about India, right, essentially today, the problem statement that we have in a country like India is that, you know, if you think about the last 10 years, I think it's really, you know, shown a big light on entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. But the funny thing I find about India is that we are actually very entrepreneurial ever since independence, pretty much, mm-hmm. right? Like, even if you go to the, you know, we are all, you know, we go around our house and we find Kirana stores, they're all run independently. It's in fact like highly unorganized in India versus the US, where most of them are chains, which are run by one company. Here, there are individuals who are entrepreneurs who are running this stuff. So to me, India is actually very entrepreneurial. And that's great because ultimately it leads to job creation, mm-hmm. right? Now, you know, although this fact is amazing, one of the things which is also a little bit sad is the fact that despite being a country which is, you know, which has so many entrepreneurs in a way, right? The sad thing is that 90% of India did not have access to formal loans, okay. right? Mm-hmm. Now, what I mean by that is essentially 90% of India cannot go to a bank and avail a loan. Mm-hmm. Now, why is loan important, right? Loan is important because if a person has a dream and they want to fulfill it, how do they do this without anybody believing in them, mm-hmm. right? It's as simple as that. So to me, I feel like, you know, if you're in a country filled with entrepreneurs, we need to enable this. We can't have a situation where 90% of India is in a situation where they don't get access to capital at fair prices, right? Obviously, there is a very, very large informal market out there, mm-hmm. which obviously provides loans to all of these guys. But what's not great about it is their collection practices, the interest rates. It's, you know, it's downright unethical if, right. if, you know, if you put it in this way, right? So what Apollo Finvest really is, right, and why we wanted to create the AWS of digital lending really is that we want to enable anybody out there which has a company, which has distribution. And by that, I mean, if they have merchants, if they have end customers, they can actually start becoming a distributor of loans via us, right. because, you know, we have the license in order to do the loans. We have the technology to enable digital loans. And most importantly, we have the capital to do that. Okay. So this is the whole thesis as to why we want to get into this. So that, you know, hopefully, you know, 10, 20 years into doing this, you know, we are a country which, you know, that 90% number has come down significantly. Yeah. And I feel like it's a very, very pivotal problem for us to solve as a country together. And this is our small attempt to try and not only us do this thing, but if we're successful, we'll inspire many other companies to try and solve the same problem.
Right.
That's pretty cool. Also, we went through your website and something we saw, like you mentioned previously, that you all are a technology first company with an NBFC license. So what do you mean by an NBFC license?
So in India, right, essentially, in order to do any kind of lending, right, you require a license from the RBI, which is the Reserve Bank of India. They basically, make sure that all of the lending which happens in India is regulated. Why do they do this? Because they want to make sure that it happens on ethical terms, mm-hmm. right? So we have the license in order to do lending, and that's what an NBFC is really.
Got you. So is there any, like, if you had to point out one difference between an NBFC and a normal bank, mm-hmm. like, is there anything that you could point out?
Oh, absolutely, right? A bank and an NBFC, right? So a bank, mostly, right, most banks which we're familiar with, things like ICICI, HDFC, things like that, they're deposit-taking entities.
Right.
What it means is people like you and me can put in our, money into the bank and they'll give us some kind of interest on top of that. And that's really how they, source most of their money in order to do the lending.
Right.
An NBFC, the full form of it is basically a non-deposit-taking bank.
Mm-hmm.
So we cannot accept deposits, from the general public. This is again done in, by the RBI in order to protect the general public into not putting into, putting money into any and every company, right? Mm-hmm. Like if it's a bank, it is... very, very heavily audited by the RBI in order to make sure that whenever the general public actually puts money into a bank, mm-hmm. it's really safe.
Fair enough.
Right? And we have one of the best regulators in the world, I feel.
Yeah.
So that's, that's broadly the difference between a bank and an NBFC.
I think, personally, this year only, I ventured into this experience of securing a loan from a normal bank, and it was very eye-opening for me personally because I didn't realize how much time it takes, how many documents are required, how many back and forth calls happen with the bank coming to my office to check where I work, etc. Now, I would consider that me personally would be a more privileged part of society, and I'm still facing so many hurdles to secure that loan.
Mm.
So how would you say Apollo Finvest is maybe solving that problem or making it easier?
So, I would say that, my thinking around, essentially loans in general is that I feel like in many ways, right, our banking system is stuck like 30 years in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The reality of the situation today is that, a lot of these problem statements can be just solved digitally.
Yeah.
Right. Like as an example, paperwork. Right. I don't understand why do you require physical paperwork at all. You can basically do everything digitally. And the reason why, the moment is now. Right. Versus like 10 years ago
mm-hmm.
is, there are a few, vectors which have happened inside India, which has made India into this phenomenal place to basically enable digital lending, right? And they're the following, right? Number one is Jio,
mm-hmm.
right? Them, what they've done in this country is, I feel it's like the equivalent of giving electricity inside India, right?
Yeah.
Like, imagine internet today goes into places where roads don't go.
Yeah.
It's amazing, right? I think it's the cheapest cost internet probably in the world.
It is.
Which is, again, amazing, mm-hmm. right? Like, I think that's to me like a case study on its own. So amazing stuff there. Second is, stuff like Aadhaar.
Mm-hmm.
That's a game changer, right? Because not only did it provide, an identification for the entire country, which could be relied upon in an offline setting, but it can also be relied upon in an online setting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is critical. Right, because obviously a key part of actually giving a loan is ensuring that the opposite person is the right person, sensible person, and KYC is critical for that to validate your identification, right? So that's the second piece. And I think the third piece, which has come in as well is UPI,
yeah.
right? Basically, it's, the way I think about UPI, it's let money free,
yeah.
right? Before UPI, right, money has always been trapped inside, I would just say this, right? Like the biggest problem, and this is across the world, not in India, the biggest problem of internet today, in my opinion, is that money has not come online, right? So a classic example of something like this is even you know, we consider Amazon to be a massive company, but even in the US today, Walmart has multiple times the revenue of Amazon. That's shocking to maybe people like us, because we're like, you know, who even goes offline and shops for basic stuff? But that's the reality of the world today. That's majority of the audience. So what really has to happen over the next decade, right, inside the internet, is that money has to go online. And what internet, again, India has done with UPI is phenomenal, right? That's, it's unbelievable. So to me, like, one of my greatest heroes inside India today is, you know, Mr. Nandan Nilekani. I think what he's done for India is unbelievable.
Correct me if I'm wrong, like, but recently, I think this year only itself, they're they're talking about how they want to extend credit lines on UPI. So I think that's something that you're talking about is happening. Maybe the money is going to show up.
100%, right? See, because the reality is, you know, India is a very interesting country, because we tend to skip generations, right? And a lot of things. Like, as an example, you know, when you think about 2G, right? That didn't really happen in India. We directly skipped to like 3G and now 4G, right? When you think about credit cards, I think it's going to be exactly the same story. I think credit cards are dead in India. They are an instrument which is serving like 100 million people again, or 50 million people, depending on, some people have like multiple credit cards. I think, you know, such instruments are going to be pointless in a place like India. I think credit on UPI is going to be basically the credit card of India. And that is super exciting. Right? Because again, you know, when you think about the banking ecosystem, and when you think about why is 90% of India excluded today, right? There are only two problems to, you know, why this is happening. Number one is the cost of customer acquisition, right? Most of India cannot afford like loans of like upwards of a lakh because they don't have the money for it, like in terms of income. So they have to be given much smaller ticket size loans. That cannot be done because traditional banks today, they have two big costs. One is basically the cost of their branch, right? And the cost of processing the loan, right?
Underwriting the loan.
Underwriting the loan, going through the paperwork. There's a lot of physical intervention there, right? So the cost of customer acquisition, which is because of the branch model, combined with basically the cost of underwriting and processing the loan, right? It makes it too expensive. It's almost to the tune of 3,000 to 5,000 rupees per loan every single time a loan has to be, you know, processed by a bank. Now, if your cost itself is this much, you cannot afford to give out a loan of 10,000 or 20,000 bucks. Like, in fact, one of the really fun exercises, which, you know, all of you guys can do, and in fact, the listeners should do, is that go to your bank and ask them to give you a 20,000 rupee loan. You know, if you have lakhs of rupees in your bank account, they will not do that. How big a joke is that? Right? Like, it's literally free money that you're handing to them. They will not do it because it's basically loss making for them. Right? That's so silly. So the reality of it all is these two things are being solved today by somebody like an Apollo. Because one, we can do everything digitally. So the cost of processing a loan is trending towards zero because we can do this at scale. The cost of customer acquisition is, you know, trending towards zero because our entire business model revolves around working with other internet companies who already have merchants, already have customers, and enable them to get a loan. Right? So that's how you solve this problem at scale.
And I think also, you know, something to take forward from financial, you know, accessibility is also literacy, right? Like, there was that report that came out which really fascinated me, the Indus Valley report, and they spoke about four different Indias and how most of the business that's happening is in India one, which is like point of tier one. So for you know, you and for your company in general, how are you tackling the financial literacy part of it? While, of course, organizations have a need, but if you have to make it accessible for people to even know how to go about it, how is that problem being solved? Or is it because you're working with different companies and internet, you know, people who work on like internet platforms? Does that solve the problem with you, or do you have to, you know, double down on literacy?
So to me, I think we have a different approach to literacy, right? I think ultimately, you know, literacy is such a problem which, you know, the only way we've been able to solve for this, right, is coming up with, you know, honestly, ethical practices ourselves, where we assume that the other person does not know stuff.
Right.
Especially when you go about, you know, this mission of financial inclusion, you know, you can't first decide that I'm going to educate the entire country, because the problem is that most people aren't interested until it's their turn you know, to take a loan.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And most of the people, right, that we end up giving out a loan to, when they need a loan, unfortunately, they just tend to just, you know, just accept everything.
Hmm.
Right? Like, they just want the money right now because it's always urgent.
Right.
So there is no time to educate. I think what's really important, and, you know, that's where, you know, players like us have to take a responsibility, knowing that the opposite person, assume they know nothing.
Hmm.
We have to be ethical. Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, one of the things that we've done, and it's on our website, is we've actually come out with an entire blog around, you know, the goal isn't basically to do digital lending or to basically capture the market over here. Right. The goal is, it should be ethical digital lending, right? Because the whole reason we want to do this in the first place is because we want to create a better version of the informal lending which is happening out there, which is already unethical, right?
Mm-hmm.
With all kind of crazy interest rates, all kind of crazy collection practices, right? We want to basically create a safe environment where our goal is a person actually ends up taking a loan from us. If they do payback, they climb up the credit ladder where they can go to maybe a bank in the future, right? Because they have a credit history, go to a bank, maybe take a loan at a much cheaper interest rate, and potentially also in their own career, right? As they advance, they actually, you know, get a better salary and they can actually afford a bigger loan for a bigger dream, essentially, right? So that's the pyramid that you want to create.
Yeah.
So just adding on to what you said, you spoke about credit history. So that's something we wanted to ask you too. So when you're just backing up, actually, so when you said that you enable other technology companies and give those services to them so they can then provide loans. So is that the buy now, pay later, like how Dunzo and many other Amazon companies have, is that the strategy?
Yes, so that's one of the products that we do. We do many such products, of course, right? Some of them are visible to the customer in this format. Some of them are actually for their merchants, right? Because they can actually scale up and, you know, instead of serving like 100 orders a day, they can serve like 10,000 orders a day,
like,
right?
Like Amazon seller. Load.
Exactly, right? Like an Amazon seller, I'll give you a classic example, right? Like an Amazon seller across the year maybe requires, you know, 100 rupees of working capital.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes Diwali season, right, when all of us want to do a lot of shopping, that time they need to have that much amount of inventory.
Yeah.
So maybe for that specific duration, instead of having 100 rupees of working capital, maybe they require 300 rupees of working capital. And, you know, those kind of volatility is something that, you know, an Apollo can come in, partner with somebody like an Amazon, and make sure that, you know, it's the best merchants over there actually get this access to capital so that they can scale up their business up and down as per the requirement of the end customers.
And I think my second question to that was, you spoke about the credit scores, etc., that while you're doing this, it'll help you boost your credit scores, that will help you later on. So like, if I, for example, go on Amazon and I do a buy now, pay later, is that then going to a CIBIL score, for example? Or is there another way that it goes about, that you record the credit score separately and then provide it to a company like CIBIL?
So all loans that you take from an NBFC, they definitely, you know, it's regulatory required for them to report it to, you know, the credit bureau authorities, which is somebody like CIBIL as an example. So definitely it's recorded with CIBIL, right? And I always encourage people to make, you know, their credit card payments, loan payments, etc., all on time, especially at a young age, because a lot of people don't know the consequences of this.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes what ends up happening is, because we don't know the consequences, sometimes we just, you know, pay it in a delayed fashion, or we don't take it seriously. Unfortunately, this can end up hurting our scores, which can become a problem in the future. Sometimes when you're, you know, when you need a loan for like something like a house or something like a car, right? Like, these are real things. You know, as we all grow up, we need to obviously get access to, you know, these kind of things. So the small loans is a way. I mean, if you have the money, obviously don't take a loan. But if you don't have the money, take it responsibly. And, you know, when you do make sure that you pay on time, because then if you don't, it gets recorded and then it ends up hurting your score.
Mm-hmm. Do you, like, it's a question that I had. Does the concept of power laws come into play with, not financial inclusion, but in this process of like for customer behavior in general? Does that come into play here, or is it, you know, not applicable?
I would say that, you know, the more lending that you do, it definitely is helpful, because ultimately, right, like, I mean, the way we have to underwrite is looking at a lot of variety of things. right? Like it's just not looking at the bureau data as an example, or the salary income. We look at a variety of factors as to where this person lives, where does this person work, their location data, variety of things, right? Which allow us to get some kind of understanding of this person's profile.
Yeah.
And the more data that you have, of course, it definitely helps in underwriting, right? Because at some point in time, you know, like any AI model essentially, right? If you have enough amount of data, you can get accuracy really, really right, which becomes pivotally important. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect also where, you know, power law really comes in and it's very helpful is the cost of processing a loan.
Right.
The more number of loans that you do, because of the underlying technologies or the APIs that you have to use, which is things like bureau reports, you know, doing their online KYC, stuff like this, right, which you have to end up taking with a regulated authority from the government. The way their pricing is, of course, is the more you do this at scale, the pricing, you know, the unit economics per pull ends up becoming cheaper. So these are two ways in which, you know, power laws really help and is helpful. The more you scale, the more beneficial it is.
Yeah. I think also just taking a step back, one thing that we discussed was in general, the fintech space, right? I come from a very like outside in view on it because, you know, we do consulting for brands and every other brand is a fintech company.
Mm-hmm.
And not everyone has this ambition at, say, of, you know, making it accessible. It's more of, okay, how do we get acquire more customers? But so obviously they bank with us further, but it isn't, I feel like the proportion of it skewed towards, you know, working towards this ambition is smaller. Most of the other, right now, I think my like from the companies we've spoken to, there's a lot of consolidation happening. You know, they all want to become like a super app and they all want to be not only do you bank with us, also mutual funds, also this, also that. So like, what is your take on, you know, what's happening in the fintech space? Because I think as the startup world for India, it's one of the largest industries and contributes a lot, of course. But I think it's a bit skewed in terms of everybody's ambition to making this happen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think about it in this way, right? At least to me, you know, I'm not a banker, right? Like, so when I got into this, I have no prior banking experience.
Right.
You know, I just got into it because, you know, like my history is essentially, I've been fortunate enough to do certain companies where, you know, we've been able to make large impacts, right? So to me, you know, the whole ambition to do Apollo was, you know, to leave like, you know, like some kind of legacy or some kind of really important mark where I know it's challenging, right? I know it's maybe sometimes naive to say that, you know, you're going to go and solve financial inclusion. I know it's almost like a government level problem to try and solve.
Right.
But, you know, ultimately, I think that's what, you know, excites me every time I wake up in the morning, right? Like that's why I want to go to work because I feel like this is a large problem statement which will, you know, continue occupying my brain for like the next 10, 20 years easily.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it depends, right? Like from founder to founder, like certain people, you know, maybe they want to just build like, you know, wildly profitable company as an example, right? Which is a fair goal. But, you know, to me as an example, like, you know, like that isn't really like the primary drive. I feel like you can have enough smart people in the room and, you know, you can do 20 different companies in the world to create something profitable.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, today that's really a challenge anymore. Like, if you're smart, you will make money. That's how I think the world works. But, you know, to do something challenging, I think, you know, that will keep you going for a long period of time. So that's one. I think on the fintech space in general, I mean, you know, the way I think about all of this stuff, right, it's honestly, everything in life is like, you know, it's like a cycle,
right?
So as an example, in 2020, everybody is going nuts because there was so much funding, right? So every Tom, Dick and Harry was starting a company. Now, you know, it seems that, you know, because of variety of factors, that funding isn't there anymore. Interest rates going up. So, you know, a lot of people want to stop, right? So I think what these things are really are like, you know, it just separates, you know, real entrepreneurs from people who just wanted to get into it because, you know, their auntie told them that their uncles, you know, some kid ended up raising funding, right? So I think what people have to kind of understand, and this is a little bit of a longer topic, but, you know, entrepreneurship is not sexy, unfortunately, right? It is like, you know, I always call it like, you know, it's like eating glass and you know, shitting out diamonds, right?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's like hardcore. It's not for the faint of heart. And, you know, you just have to feel like, I mean, that is the way I at least I always recommend people to think about it is, you should build a company as if there's always perennially a recession. Yeah. Right? Like that's at least been our strategy. Doesn't matter what's going on outside, like, you know, whether the other person wants to give you like $100 million or he wants to give you like 0 rupees, how does it matter? Like, you know, it's your company, it's your baby, like you want to grow it up the way you want to grow it up. So I think that's really critically important. A lot of consolidation, I think, ends up happening because you create business models which, you know, inherently don't make sense.
Yeah.
Or you end up like, you know, just having, not being very disciplined when you run the company. So sometimes those can be real issues which you want to, you know, solve with really foundational 101 principles when you start the company on its own. So I think that's how you should think about that.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you shared that because, I mean, the next thing we wanted to do was switch gears to your journey with entrepreneurship. And when we spoke earlier, you mentioned something that, you know, what you're doing right now with, you know, financial inclusion. You did at Hotstar with entertainment. You've done that with health tech at Farm Easy. So a little bit now more doubling down on your journey as to, you know, what makes you drawn to solving, you know, such huge problems. And a second question to that is, how do you go about building your team, engineering it? You know, what's sort of your philosophy, you know, to tackle such large challenges?
I think one is I'm just like a genuinely very curious person, you know. So like my only North Star in life is like everything I do will be connected to technology. Because like, you know, that's like my muse. I'm obsessed with tech. Like in general, in my free time, you'll see me, you know, doing some random stuff.
Right.
You know, it'll all be around, you know, but tech in general. So everything else is just a problem which I look at in a way that, you know, given the technology vectors which exist today, right, which didn't exist maybe 5-10 years back, can we do something special here, right? Mm-hmm. Can we do something which fundamentally couldn't be done before? When I think about businesses also, I really believe in, you know, constantly about this thing about you have to create, you know, businesses which have unfair advantages,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I think, you know, I'm very, very paranoid about creating a business which doesn't have an X factor inside it.
Right.
Because, you know, it's so competitive out there, right? Like, you just can't, as an example, decide to build something because you want to build something,
yeah.
right? Like the first
yeah.
question I have to myself is, why am I so special that I am the one to be able to solve the problem? Because, you know, many people can think about ideas, right?
Yeah.
It's not a big deal to think about an idea. Nowadays, it's not even a big deal to execute it to some degree, right? But in order to win, you have to have like a really, really unfair advantage.
Yeah.
So, and this isn't something which I, you know, have, you know, learned since day zero, right? I've just learned it by building businesses. So as an example, at Farm Easy, one of the huge unfair advantages we had is that we ended up working with one of my friend's distribution companies and he'd been at it for like 3-4 years,
right?
So when we started Farm Easy, we had all of his knowledge day zero. So that gave us a huge unfair advantage as compared to some of our competitors who were building everything from the ground up, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was huge. I mean, when I did Hotstar, you know, I already knew at Star, essentially, like if you look at their offline data, people are obsessed about watching these, you know, basically shows, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody at our home is watching
something,
Star, something or the other related to Star, right? So there was clear product market fit. All they really needed was somebody to build like amazing tech to distribute this across the world pretty
mm-hmm.
much, right? And I knew that I had the ability to at least build a tech. Content I can't create. They already had amazing content. So that was the unfair advantage over here. With Apollo, I feel the unfair advantage was really twofold, right? One is, thankfully, when I started this was a company which was already existing in my home. My dad started in it in the 1980s. It was already public, right? Nothing really was happening inside the company. So we had the NBFC waiting at home. Second is, obviously, being 10 years into this industry, I had a lot of friends who were in the fintech industry, a lot of them telling me exactly what the problem was, really out of frustration, you know, not knowing that I could do something about it. And that really led to basically my ability of kickstarting this and having a lot of traction early on. And initially, it was a hobby, right?
Yeah.
It was a hobby where I was just like, okay, let me help a bunch of, you know, friends out and see if what happens. But now it's become something which I feel like can be really, really huge. So that's how I've gone about doing that.
You said something really interesting before, is that run a business like it's always in recession.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we were seeing when you started Apollo Finvest, and it was in 2018. And during that same time, there were a lot of NBFC crises happening with ILFS, etc. So now you're entering into this space. So like as a CEO, as a entrepreneur, what learnings did you have like entering a market that was in somewhat of a crisis?
You know, I really, really strongly believe in one thing, that, you know, when there is a crisis, it's an opportunity,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I think, like everything in life, I really do believe everything is like a wave,
mm-hmm.
right? Sometimes it's high tide, sometimes it's low tide. You know, you just have to basically know that everything comes to an end,
mm-hmm.
right? Whether it's a good cycle or a bad. So to me, you know, even today, right? Like when people talk about this funding winter and all this stuff, or there's an ILFS crisis, all of this stuff which happens, always I tell my team that, you know, if it's a crisis out there, we need to be the ones who are aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to hiring, because like there's a lot of talent available, which people are panicking, firing people, doing all of that stuff. We need to go on the aggressive, out of like 100 people, find the best one, mm-hmm. right? And get them inside the company. Because
mm-hmm.
like, you know, you're going to get them at a really, really reasonable cost.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. Number two, be aggressive and acquire a lot of business, right?
Yeah.
Because people are afraid, right? People don't want to do this business. People feel like, oh, digital space, very risky, all of that
yeah.
nonsense. I'll be like, listen, I'm going to take that risk because I know exactly how to control the risk,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So I think every time there is panic,
mm-hmm.
you have to be thinking, you know, a little bit, you know, what I try to do is I try to like zen out and just try to think in my mind, what is the opportunity over here, right?
Mm-hmm.
What can we do where we can take advantage of the chaos, really, and, you know, pick off things, right? And that's why, you know, you should build companies in a way that, you know, like I always say, right, like build it for like the next 10, 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
So that there is no rush, right? It's fine to slow down completely,
yeah.
right? It's fine to go, you know, at a warp speed as well. You have to be in control.
Yeah.
I think the biggest misconception nowadays today is that because of, you know, this investor mindset and VC mindset and everybody wants results like yesterday,
mm-hmm.
people are always going 100 miles an hour regardless of what is the traffic situation,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And that just leads to so many crashes of companies, right? Which is what you need to avoid.
Yeah.
Because what people should also understand is that ultimately, you know, when you're building a company, you know, no matter what, it's a very, very personal experience.
Yeah.
Right? It's like literally raising up a child,
mm-hmm.
right? So you know, when you have a company which works, I would say that, you know, most companies don't. Right.
Yeah.
So even as an employee, or if you're an early stage employee, or if you're an, you know, entrepreneur who has a company which is working, hold on to it with dear hands. Right.
Yeah.
Like absolutely, like, do not let this stuff go. Don't let anybody screw with it, because, you know, what you've got is a miracle. Right. It doesn't happen. Like most companies do fail.
Yeah.
So, you know, treat it very nicely and, you know, really nurture it and grow it up, because if you can, you know, you can create a legacy for 20, 30, 40 years,
yeah.
which is amazing, right? Like how many people get a chance to do that?
Yeah. I think that mindset is so important, because I feel like with our culture now, it's, and including us, like it's a lot of hype, right? It's a culture of hype. Like right now it is AI, earlier, and AI is, I mean, big proponent, but like, you know, there's this meme, okay, it was crypto, now it's AI, now it's something else. And like, you will see a flood of companies, flood of founders coming in to cash out on the gold without this mindset that, you know, we're in it to A, solve a problem, and B, to nurture something long-term and not just, you know, take our bit and get out of it, which, I mean, it's really impressive to hear that, because, yeah, like the more we read, we every day we're like, making jokes about these things, but I'm quite inspired by what
yeah.
you said. I just wanted to add. We'll just again shift gears. I mean, it's a continuation, but talk about, you know, you had said something interesting when we spoke earlier about your approach to building a team, you know, that you're very, very specific about, you know, who you hire, number one. And number two, you had mentioned that you have a different approach to competition. Instead of thinking of them with, you know, an arm's length, you go out there and speak to your competition, which again, I hadn't really heard of earlier. So can you elaborate a bit on that as well?
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, to me, like the most important ingredient inside a startup is definitely your team,
yeah.
right? So, you know, I encourage people to, you know, really spend a lot of time in building the right team. And by, you know, the right team, I mean, like, you know, different phases of the company require different sets of people.
Mm-hmm.
So as an example, like when you're starting out, you know, a company, it's foolish to think you're going to go out there and compete with the best companies in the world to hire the kind of talent that they are hiring,
right?
Right? You just can't afford that realistically because, you know, even if you are able to ending up getting a person who's working at an amazing company, you know, it's very difficult for that person to change mindset from going, you know, from a very large company, which is amazing, to a tiny company, which has like 5-10 people,
mm-hmm.
right? You ideally need to find the right people who are mentally tuned to ready to work in that kind of environment, right? So as an example, in our journey, always what we've tried to do is find the right, you know, kind of people at the right moment,
yeah.
right? There is a moment in time where I call it like the 0-1 journey where you're, it's, mm-hmm. it's very, very, you know, a lot of things in flux, right?
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people also say this, that, you know, startups are chaos, but I absolutely don't agree to that. Startups are not chaotic at all. Chaotic startups are run by amateur founders, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Like, what you should try to do is basically have goals which you clearly define, right? In the form of numbers, right?
Yeah.
Like, have one KPI, two KPIs, three KPIs, not more. You literally plaster it on your walls to make sure your entire team knows what is it that we are chasing.
Yeah.
And one of the things I really believe in, and I've seen this happen constantly, most startups fail because these goals keep changing,
yeah.
right? Or they chase like 10 things.
Yeah.
If you have the right team and you give them one goal and you allow them to work on this for like a good amount of time, I promise you magic will happen,
yeah.
right? Because when smart people combine and they really work together with great chemistry and they have a clear target in mind, they are an unstoppable force,
yeah.
right? Only the only person who can stop them is you by meddling with the process, right? So don't do that. When I hire also, right, like one of the things I try to do is you try to hire people with an X factor, right? Mm-hmm. I look for people who've done something in their, like one of the things which are very important to me is that if somebody says that they're interested in something, it could be anything under the sun,
yeah.
right? It could be, I'm really interested in cricket. It could be really interested in football, whatever it is, right? I really try to dig deep into it where I'll ask you 25 questions about literally that topic,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you've told me you're passionate about it.
Yeah.
Now, what am I trying to do over here? I'm trying to see, I don't want to work with superficial people, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to work with people who have 10 passions and are not in depth about anything because it makes me feel that you literally are passionate about something, but you know your knowledge is superficial about even that.
Yeah.
That means you as a person are not committed into something, right? Which I don't like.
Mm.
The reason for this is because if I find a person who is passionate about anything, then it's up to me as a founder to get you as passionate about what am I trying to solve for. And I'm very confident of selling it to that person, right? Because the reason why I'm doing it is I'm super excited.
Mm.
So if you join me and spend enough time with me, I'm sure I can get you excited about what I'm going to do. And then if you're a person who can go into depth into any topic, then I know you'll go, you know, crazily deep into this topic as well. And we can really work well together because I like to work with people who like do deep work.
Yeah.
I hate people who do superficial work.
Yeah.
Like even if you submit anything to me and if it's like superficial and I find 10 errors inside it, it's a problem statement because for me, like it shows you don't care about the quality of your work, right?
Yeah.
Like, and it's not so much about that I care about my time, but I don't like people who don't respect themselves to create good work for themselves. Like, it's not about me, it's about you, right?
Yeah.
Like
respecting yourself to do the work.
Right? Yeah. Like your name is attached to something. So you should really feel a pride within yourself that if my name is attached to this, this better be extremely high quality or I don't want to be part of it at all.
Yeah.
Like that's how I think. And so I want people to feel that way as well. So that's, you know, another point. I think the next point is when it comes to hiring, right? You know, a lot of companies I feel have a really poor hiring process. And by that I mean, you know, the interview process is screwed up.
Horrible.
They will not treat candidates really well. You know, so one of the things which really changed, you know, this entire thing for me is, you know, before I joined Hotstar, I actually was interviewing with Google as well, right? So, you know, at that point in time, I had a, you know, A+ user experience when it came to actually interviewing with them, right? I feel like that changed my entire mental mind frame about how to hire people, right? Like essentially, you know, few practices which we have, right? Essentially, number one is we have a dedicated proper question bank, which, you know, like a lot of people, you know, I say like a lot of people do vibe interviews,
yeah,
which is just like a vibe check,
yeah,
right, which is terrible.
That happened with me.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, which is terrible, right? Yeah. Because like, you know, if I'm, it's like going on a blind date, half an hour, anybody's nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? It's about like, are you intellectually smart or not?
Yeah.
Right? Depending on the job.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think what people do is that people don't take it that seriously. They just like, you know, they just hire because they want to hire. Mm. I think what you have to do is literally like, depending on the job role, go out there, find out the best set of questions you can ask and determine what the answer should be and try to evaluate the person in a very, very quantitative fashion, right? And if you have multiple rounds, decide, you know, what are the questions which are going to be asked in the round one? What are the questions going to be asked in the round two? What are the questions going to be asked in round three? So it's a very, very systematic process which eliminates all false positives, right? You want to eliminate all false positives, right? What you want to get into is a zone where after taking this interview, you actually can evaluate whether this person is a strong hire, a hire, or not a hire.
Mm-hmm. Do you factor in like things like personality and all of that, or it's very set on, you know, job profile? Like, that's a question I always have, because like you said, a lot of people do vibe checks on, is this person collaborative? Are they not, you know, not only related to the job function?
So the way we break it down, right, is that essentially in the start, we are very, very technical, right? Because to me, there are, you know, it's two things. Of course, you need to have the right personality. But to me, the first check before I even check your personality is going to be like, are you technically right for this role?
Right.
Once I discover you're technically right, like then we will have like maybe a half an hour round, which is a pure cultural round, right? Where we'll ask you scenario questions and what do you do and things like that.
Yeah.
So it has to, of course, you know, culturally fit, because you can have the smartest person in the world.
Exactly.
But if they're culturally like not the right person in the team, they're going to stand out like a sore thumb.
Yeah.
So you have to have like a two-pronged approach here. But I definitely spend a lot more time technically making sure the person is absolutely right. Half an hour is more than enough if you have the right questions to kind of do the cultural check. And then that person basically comes in.
Hmm.
If you do this again, we found this to be wildly successful.
Yeah.
Because, you know, then frankly, you know, when I conduct interviews like this, was this in the past where I've seen vibe checks happen? I'm actually now excited for people when they join us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, I'll be like, oh my God, this person is so smart.
Yeah.
Right? Because I've asked this, you know, similar questions to like 10 people and I found like average answers. Good. So when one person gives me an amazing answer, I'm literally excited after the interview saying, we're going to do what it takes to get this person in.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people don't do that.
Yeah. Right? I mean, in my experience, zero.
Yeah. Right? And you know, the sad part is, you know, so many times there will be really smart candidates and sometimes they'll actually rightfully ask for a little bit more compensation and a lot of people will just be like, no.
Yeah.
Because they actually have not taken the effort to realize that actually that person's a diamond.
Yeah, and worth
absolutely.
That.
They're absolutely,
I mean,
worth it.
You're still talking in 100 years ahead. Like, maybe because we're not in tech, like I've gone to interviews where they still will take the physical copy of the CV and I'm sitting in front of them and they still go over just the CV and that's about it, you know, which is so, I mean, I was obviously...
And still do this. What's your strengths? What's your
So, I mean, I think a lot is required in that space, but I just wanted to rewind a bit on what something that you said. Like one of my mentors had told me, so I'm guilty of this, of... Like, I was guilty of this, of appearing to know a lot of things, you know, like reading a bunch of stuff. But if you would ask me 20 questions on it, I wouldn't be able to answer, you know. But I had this need of keeping up with everything. And he was like, you know, it's not. And he said, do you want to be a specialist or a generalist? And not with the newer idea, the earlier idea of it. And I was like, well, I don't know if I can be a specialist in something. You know, I like knowing everything. And he just was like, you're not going to learn anything. Like, you will never, ever learn anything deeply if you have this approach. And then that's when I started to understand, okay, what am I actually interested in? And I think a lot of people our age are guilty of that, right? Like
of having so many passions and talking
so many
about
passions,
everything under the sun.
Yeah, or, you know, not wanting to appear as though I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Like if for example, you talk about something and I don't know, there's this fear of like, oh my God, like I'm going to be judged if I don't know it. And I think that's also really important for someone who's starting their career to, you know that it's fine. You don't need to know everything about everything. Invest time in understanding sort of like what you're interested in. So do you have like any advice on that regard? For because I actually realized quite late in my ओली कर रही हो.
I mean, I'll tell you the beautiful part about like being very, very young is that you can actually be the dumbest person in the room.
Yeah, that's also so underrated. You know, yeah. You want to appear super smart, but it's okay. Like,
no, in fact, like, I mean, I'll tell you, right? Like when I started my career, I didn't want to be in rooms where I was remotely like the smartest person in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I'm not learning crap.
Yeah.
Right? Like you have to actually actively seek people. Even today, you know, like actually the people I enjoy talking to, like, you know, in outside work are people who actually make me feel like, oh my God, like I don't know nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And there are certain people like this and I enjoy my time with them. I literally like would be like, you know, when are you free?
Yeah.
Right? I just want to hang out with you because they will be like an encyclopedia about topics and I'll just be in awe of them.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, life is more about actually being in constant learning mode. But also at the same point in time, like, you know, there is, you know, you have to be very confident in your own skin, right? You don't have to be like a person. You don't have to appear anything. See, ultimately, the thing which is most important in life, right, is that if you become a jack of all trades and master of none, I think it's a huge problem. And it's also a lot to do with, you know, we live in like a high information age, right?
Yes.
So everybody's constantly on social media. Everything is everything. You know, news is everything. Even if I don't want to know about, I don't know, like what Kim Kardashian is doing, it pops up everywhere.
Yeah,
like it's so much unnecessary information which is, you know, thrown at us. I think what you should try to do and everybody should try to do is, you know, pick certain topics which you're really passionate about. You know, it's like reading, right, to me. Like as an example, like, you know, probably 10 years back, I used to not like reading at all.
Yeah.
Right. I was like this person where, you know, let me know when the movie is out for that. Right. So, you know, now what I've actively done is that I only read stuff which I like.
Yeah.
And it can be a comic book. Yeah. It can be literally like, I don't know, like, you know, recently I was reading about this amazing, like, you know, science fiction novel called 1978.
Hmm.
Right. So just random stuff like this, wherever, you know, whatever interests me, I read only that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Not stuff like, oh, you know, I'll get 10 recommendations. You should read The Psychology of Money. I'm like, I'm not interested.
Yeah.
Right. Like this is in school.
Yeah.
Right? There is no syllabus now. Like what we have to train our minds to do is encourage whatever it is that you're interested in. Go deep in that, in that zone. Right. As an example, you know, I'm obsessed with like, you know, people like, I really like to know more about Elon Musk, Steve Jobs, all of these guys, right? I've read everything, you know, about them because it's interesting. To me, it's not like work. It doesn't feel like, oh, I'm reading this. It's boring. It's like a school homework, right?
Yeah.
I think that's what all of us should try to do is really go deep into areas which you're interested in. If you feel like it's superficial, you're wasting your time going into that kind of stuff, right? Because it's not something which is going to amount to anything, knowing just, you know, superficially something.
Yeah.
So I think what everybody should try to do in their early years is figure out what is it that you're truly interested in, right? It's a process of elimination sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes you'll already know. Like I knew since a very, very early age that, you know, and everybody knew around me very annoyingly that I was obsessed with tech.
Yeah.
Right? Like I remember like when the first iPhone launched, I was marketing it at my home for like a year before that I bought this. You all better be prepared that I'm going to take this, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, all of those things, signs are there and I'm sure it's there for everybody.
Yeah.
So I think you just have to recognize what is it that you're into and lean hard into that and go for that. Like ignore the rest.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, I think what you said about process of elimination, people are just generally scared to fail. And like getting into something, okay, maybe little, and then realizing, oh, this is not me. And then, oh, I have to start over again. That concept of, oh, I have to start over and over and over again. I think that's what people get scared about. But you're right, like to eventually be able to find your passion, you need to like go through different roads and maybe you'll go here, maybe you'll go there, but eventually you'll reach there.
So, you know, on this topic, right? Like maybe I'll give you guys a little bit more relatable stories, right? So, you know, you talked about like, you know, being afraid to fail, right? So I'll tell you about stories where I failed like and failed hard, right? So imagine when I came back to India, right? This is in 2010 and I had no work experience, nothing. And I came back, you know, and, you know, I was figuring out, okay, life, what do you want to do? And this is like, I had like job offers in the US, of course, when you know, graduate from there, all my friends took up these job offers. But, you know, my mom was a single mom alone over here. So I was like, okay, I'll come back and, you know, pretend like I can take care of you like I can. But So when I came back, you know, all my, you know, friends and whatever family members, etc., they were helping me, you know, get a job.
Yeah.
And, you know, my family actually found somebody at Reliance and, you know, magically I landed up over there. And those 3 months were the worst 3 months of my life, right? Like, imagine, like, you know, I go over there and within the first month, I'm like, I'm quitting,
yeah.
right? And I tell everybody at my home, like, I'm quitting. This is the worst company in the world. And, you know, all of them are shocked because they're like, this is the best company in the world, like, you know, massive company. How can you call them, like, you know, rubbish, you don't know anything. And so I'm like,
Mukesh Bhai.
Exactly, right? Like, so everybody's like, and, you know, rightfully so, right? I mean, he's a great entrepreneur.
Yeah.
But unfortunately for me, like, it's a really terrible experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I wanted to leave. Within the first month over there, I realized this is a horrible place. I put in my, you know, resignation and they tell me there's a 3 month notice period.
Those are the worst.
Yeah, imagine.
This 2 months, 3 months, just be a 2 week notice and let me bounce.
So I turned out to be the worst employee in the world because what I used to do.
You left.
No, I stayed, right? And I
silent quitting.
I stayed and how? You know what I used to do? They had limited internet hours in office.
Right.
Okay. So I was like, you know, screw everything. I was literally getting depressed with them, like yeah. the crowd and everything over there. There's this website called Coursera.
Right.
I started watching Coursera videos over there and my manager used to sit next to me and she used to actually give me work and I used to just not do it.
Ignore it,
right? She used to literally tell me, you're the worst employee I've ever had. How can you just ignore your manager? And
yeah.
this was like, you know, she was like a 53-year-old lady.
Yeah.
She's just losing her mind, yeah. seeing like, how is this person?
Like, what's happening?
Yeah, he's blatantly disregarding anything. She's like, I'm not going to give you a relieving letter. I was like, do what you want. I'm not wasting my life around this. You scared me. Like, in yeah. a way, this scared me.
Like, corporate is not for me.
Yeah, like, I was like, this is like, this can't be my life. Like, yeah. it's depressing, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I did that. You know, I took out those 2-3 months to really sharpen up my skills because I still literally do assignments and everything. I was like, it woke me up.
Anything
to get out. Like, yeah. I'll do whatever it takes yeah. to get out of this place.
Yeah.
And that, you know, bounced me into basically getting to another job after that, right? Which is a company called, you know, GEP. And that manager was like amazing.
Yeah.
Right? He literally, quote unquote, in the interview told me, what is a person like you doing over there?
Yeah.
I said, I don't know.
People right? matter so much. The people you work
yeah.
with.
Yeah, yeah. He was such a classy manager, right? I loved him. Then in parallel to that, right, that's when I realized that, listen, like, all of this stuff is actually not for me. I did a startup in parallel to having a job at GEP.
Mm-hmm.
I created a company called Me Wants. No, it's not Wow. It's a terrible story. Right? So that was a colossal failure,
yeah.
right? Because we basically did a company which was Dunzo,
mm-hmm.
like pretty much Dunzo in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of there being delivery boys, anybody could become a delivery boy.
Okay.
Right? Imagine if you just put a request right now saying, I want a Starbucks coffee, and anybody
who is in Starbucks will be like, okay,
can pick it up and just, you know, for $50 extra, drop it here.
Yeah.
Right? So we created that app. It failed colossally.
Right.
Right? Because we did the biggest mistake, which was like launching it in the US, sitting in India. Right?
Oh.
So we literally, by the way, I think got zero orders. Right? Like, that was how badly we failed. But that led me into getting hired at Coupon Dunya.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because when I interviewed, and that was a company which had 4 people when I joined. Yeah. Right? It was a terrible website, everything bad. I just wanted to be inside that startup. So when I interviewed over there, right, literally Samir was the founder and CEO. He literally told me one thing. I'm hiring you as the head of product over here because you know exactly what not to do. Because what I did after this company did not work out is that I actually wrote, you know, an entire, you know, like a note to myself about what are my learnings over here and what will I never do again, right? And in my interview, I actually, you know, showed it to him because in a way, this was like mentally trying to get a closure.
Yeah.
Cathartic experience.
It was, right? Like, because, I mean, I was so fed up by the end of it. I was like, I'm shutting this thing. This is madness.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, all my family around me and friends around me, they were having more of a problem. Like, how can you shut this company? No. They were emotionally attached.
Yeah.
I was like, listen, good riddance. I can't do this anymore. This is madness. Because obviously, I used to, you know, this is something which we used to do along with work.
Yeah.
Right? Imagine you reach home at 7 o'clock and then till 3 o'clock in the night, you're sitting and working.
Yeah.
And you're not even getting one order. What nonsense is this, right? So, terrible experience. But what I'm trying to say is that sometimes failing is actually great. Because everything teaches you a lesson. And sometimes it's a wake-up call and you just be like, oh my God, this life is so terrible. It'll stun you into doing something, you know, working your butt off to do something. And that'll lead you to, you know, amazing things in life.
Yeah. What you just said, like, oh, your parents were also so attached. Your family was so attached to your company. So I feel like something I hear from many entrepreneurs is like, oh, you have started a company, it's your baby. Now it's not working, but you just keep attaching. You're like, you don't let go. So from your experience, like, when is the, how would you advise people to, this is the right time to maybe let go and start something else?
I think when you're burnt out, that's how I would say. Honestly, everything before that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, everything is pivotable.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I think realistically, if you ask me, theoretically, I feel no startup should fail.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because you just keep pivoting, keep talking to customers. Eventually, you know, they'll, you know, the right way to build a company is to basically be like a monk.
Mm-hmm.
I am just a medium to serve my customers. That's it. Ignore your own desires, essentially, mm-hmm. right? Because most people build a company that they want, they think is cool, and that leads to disaster. Because unfortunately, most of the people who are building the company are like 1% or 0.1% of India, and they don't know what India wants,
mm-hmm.
right? Including me.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to completely be zoned into your customer. Whatever they want, I'll build. If it's like the shittiest thing under the world, I, you know, like as an example, I know literally, you know, a founder who makes, you know, very, very well known coffee brand.
Uh-huh.
He hates his own coffee.
Oh.
Right? He's like, never would I drink that.
Yeah.
But this is what my customers want, so I make it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And when he started, by the way, he was complete opposite.
Right.
He used to make this niche coffee, which, you know, like coffee lovers would love. And he would be like, this is, you know, amazing.
Yeah. Wow, wow.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, exactly. Right? And now he's like, you know, they want sweet coffee. I'm going to give it to them. Right?
Yeah.
That's what they want. This is how a company works. So I think a lot of those things, you know, you have to happen. But I think all of this stops when you just feel you're burnt out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When you're burnt out, it's over.
Yeah.
Right? Because the driving force inside a company is the founder.
Mm-hmm.
You are the cheerleader. You are the person who believes when nobody believes.
Yeah.
Right? And in, there are 8 out of 10 days when nobody believes.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's what running a company is, in at least in the initial days.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to actually drive positive momentum. Like every day you have to come into office and be like, we're going to kill it. We're going to do it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because actually inside a startup, right, it's all about positive momentum. It's about small wins.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I really recommend for entrepreneurs is that when you're starting, set up really attainable, small, tiny goals.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is when your team starts believing that you set up a goal and they've actually accomplished it, no matter even how small it is, right, even about setting up a website, even about getting 10 customers, if they feel they're able to accomplish stuff, they start believing that they're invincible.
Yeah.
And that's the magical feeling, you know. I found that, you know, constantly, like, you know, I had this zone where in PharmEasy, we felt we could do anything. If at that point in time, you had told us, build like a rocket ship to go to moon, we would have said, we'll do it.
Yeah.
Because you feel invincible when you start, you know, winning quite a lot, right? Same thing with Hotstar, right? When we got to like from 7 million monthly actives to 350 monthly actives, that was like 70% of India's smartphone market.
Yeah.
We felt we could do anything under the sun.
Yeah.
Right. So those are those moments, right, where you actually feel you're unstoppable. And the way to get your team to be in that kind of mind space, right, is to give them attainable targets, make them achieve them, and then you see what happens.
Yeah. Wow. I was just like thinking.
But you spoke about burnout. So like, and you spoke so much about your employees and team building. Something I have faced in my previous job is that I was just totally burnt out and I didn't feel supported maybe by my company to be able to like get over it or move on. And then I was just like, bye, sayonara, I need to leave. So is there something that you recommend other entrepreneurs do or you do yourself to ensure, besides these small wins, that your employees stay motivated and like avoid that phase of like burnout?
I think honestly, you know, like when you're an entrepreneur and when you have employees, I think you are their agony aunt. There's no way from getting away from that, right? If they have personal problems, they are goddamn your problems.
Yeah.
That's how I think, right? If like my employee is sad for whatever reason, I have to be listening to them. I have to like try and go out of my way to help them because otherwise they'll underperform.
Yeah.
So you can, you know, it's just scientifically, you know, and very selfishly the right thing to do. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you have to selfishly be unselfish.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, you have to help them because if they are not psychologically in the right place, there is no way a human being can do this.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, the minute I see, you know, employees in a funk, I'll just tell them, listen, you take 2 weeks off. Right?
Yeah.
Just go to Goa, chill, do whatever the hell you want. Just, you know, I don't want a person working at 70% capacity because what ends up happening is that not only that person is underperforming, other people start underperforming.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
They are carrying their load on and then it's just extra.
No, and their energy as well. Like you said, positive momentum, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, it happens to me. Like, I need to go to my boss and like, I need her to be that agony aunt and then it's fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, absolutely. Even my, like, other partner who's a founder had said this, because that's what I was thinking about. He had told me it's also a mindset. Like, you can come in think, even if you're not the founder, come in thinking it's yours and be that energizer for everybody. And that makes a difference, as opposed to I'm coming here to do my work. And a lot of times I shuffle between that, and the energy difference is crazy. Like, if I'm like, oh, I'm doing my work, I have a very like, okay, this is what I'm doing, there's no connection. But if I feel like, okay, guys, we're working towards something, even if it's a small presentation, completely different energy, completely different attitude. So I feel like that's also very, very, very important and difficult, in my opinion. Like, I'm still trying to keep consistent in that, you know.
I think the biggest thing I tell people, right, and I've done this always, is always go in with owner mentality, regardless of whether you're the owner or not. I did this at Hotstar.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically, I think that one of the reasons why we won over there is because, you know, essentially they allowed me to be that person.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's, and you need to work with the managers who actually appreciate such kind of people, right? Yeah. Like, I love those kind of people, by the way. If there is a person who out there, you know, who in my team is having this kind of ownership mentality, I'll be like, oh my God, no more power to this person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? Let me just clear out everything in the way. Because the reality is that no one person, whether it's the founder or whether it's not the founder, can do this. Yeah. You actually need to take turns. And that's what the whole, you know, that's what the entire management team is all about.
Yeah.
So I think everybody needs to have this mentality. And I would encourage all, you know, people who are doing a job also should go into the job with an ownership mentality. Because that's when you will feel, you know, you're conquering, and you know, that's where you'll bring the positive energy. And you should work with bosses who encourage this.
Yeah.
If you have a boss who's insecure and feels like, oh my God, you need to stay in your lane, that's a terrible person to work with.
Yeah.
Right? I love people who do like stuff which is way beyond their payroll.
Yeah.
Like, I want a person who wants to, like, I don't know, if they're working in tech, they'll be like, listen, you know, I went into accounts and they have this messed up system over there. I fixed it.
Hmm.
I'd be like, more power to you, right? Yeah. Like, what do you want to do next, right? You want to take over HR? Like, that's the person you want. You want a person who wants to do everything under the sun. They want to feel like this is my company.
Yeah.
And that's what you want to empower. You want more people feeling this way.
Yeah.
You don't want to work with, you know, bosses who are insecure and be like, oh my God, this person's going to take my job. Like, the right boss will be like, take my job.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't want to do this shit. I want less work to do. Yeah. I want to nurture my team into becoming a unit which performs regardless of. In fact, like, one of the KPIs that I have for my managers is that if you go on a vacation and your team does not perform well, you are a terrible manager.
Yeah.
Right? Because I don't want a manager who's somebody who's like, you know, my team is crap, I make up for them, I work like, you know, Saturday, Sunday, like a crazy person, and it's fine. Like, you're a terrible coach.
Yeah.
Right? Like, this is like saying that, you know, you're not able to basically nurture a team. Then I don't want you.
Yeah.
Right? Then you're not a manager. You be like a team member. I'll find somebody who's really good at coaching the team and making sure that they perform amazingly well, regardless of whether you exist or not.
Yeah. That's so important. I feel like that mindset, most of the times, is missing in most people.
Yeah.
But like you were saying,
no, I was just going to say, like, a good way that we wanted to also, you know, wrap up was to ask you what your inspirations have been, and also just some recommendations from you, whether it's books, podcasts, whatever it might be, so that, you know, other people can also be inspired.
I think, you know, to me, essentially, like, what inspires me at least is I like to, you know, whenever I feel down or uninspired, right, I just like to see other entrepreneurs talk about their journeys.
Yeah.
Because it makes me feel like, A, I'm not alone, right? And B, sometimes I feel like when I hear about other people's problems and how they solved it, I don't know, magically sometimes I end up getting a solution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy, right? I've always found this to be true. I can be having like the most crappiest day ever, but if I like put on a video about, I don't know, any entrepreneur, it can be like the, you know, founder of Nike, it can be the founder of Walmart, anybody just talking about their journeys and, you know, the shit that they went through, and then they found a solution for it. I somehow feel like I also have an idea, I can do something. And it'll be like randomly, like it's almost like my mind while watching the video subconsciously is thinking about my problem and it comes up with a solution while I'm watching this thing, and after the video I'll be like, oh my God, I have a solution.
Yeah.
Or reading something which is just like about other people's journeys. It's that's what kind of keeps me inspired. So I would tell everybody that whatever, you know, career you're in, right, whoever is the person in that space that you look up to, you know, read up about them. Like, you know, find a way to inspire yourself, right? Find some figure and, you know, to keep yourself like enlightened, spark, you know, keep the spark going basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, I think this last question that we'll ask you, but our podcast is called Work in Progress. So like, how are you a work in progress, and maybe where do you see yourself in the next 5-10 years?
What other problems will you be solving?
I really honestly, you know, at this point in time, just so occupied with this, right? So I really can't think beyond it. In fact, I tell a lot of people this, that, you know, I just can't think of other problems at all right now. Like, to me, like, this is all encompassing. And especially, I think also from my own perspective, right, you know, like 1 year back, I ended up, you know, I had a daughter, right? So like, to me now, you know, I have two things in my life, which take up all my time. Right. And like, I'm in no mood. I mean, I can't even think of a third thing. Right. Like, frankly, like, if I was ever to stop Apollo, I would just be happy staying at home with my daughter. I think, you know, till the time she entertains me. So, you know, after that, obviously, she'll be like, you need to find some other hobby. But yeah, I think these two things just take up all of my time. So, you know, honestly, I probably, hopefully 5 years down the line, I think one thing which I'm finding more about myself is, you know, fundamentally, like, I really like working with entrepreneurs in general. And I think I've had the privilege over the last 5 years with in Apollo to work with many different companies and, like, you know, literally 50 different companies we've worked with. And I really enjoyed working with entrepreneurs, you know, helping them build something special, right? So at some point in time, I think, you know, I'll probably follow that thread, I feel. To be able to do something more on the lines of getting to work with many, many early stage founders. This is already giving me that opportunity, but maybe double down on that at some point in time if I get a chance to. But yeah, I think these are the things which are at least going on in my mind.
No, you absolutely should, because I'm so inspired after this talk. So I feel like 100%, like, there's a lot for you to offer already. So I can't imagine 5-10 years down the line. Like, I think you would impact a lot of, not only early stage founders, but I think everyone you have these conversations with. So thank you so much for, you know, sharing this space with us and, like, educating us.
Honestly, it was, while we are not entrepreneurs, so to speak, there was still so much to, like, grasp and learn from it.
And actually, we learned a lot. Like, a lot of times, honestly, when we've, in our early history of doing this, it's been a bit more conversational. But I think today we really took back a lot. Like, I really learned.
We'll marinate in the information.
But
thank you so much, honestly. Hope you guys enjoyed this podcast, and see you next time.